and things like that.
So it was always very clear to us that there were civilizations and people on the land that we were farming before we were there. And that was always very much clear. I went to one of the schools in Iowa that was and still is known as the Clarksville Indians. And that was our team name and mascot. Come on, Mark, if you want to join us. There. And so I'll come back and pick up on that part of the story, but I wound up in Minneapolis after going to a Christian college in Northeast Iowa. Aaron Rochester moved up to Minneapolis, really felt called towards urban ministry, which is a whole nother story. And in the early 90s, we wound up inheriting a building that I was pastoring a church at that had been built by a group called the American Indian Evangelical Church. And that group had split at one time. They had disintegrated to just a small handful of people. So they wound up gifting that building to us after I went ice fishing with the pastor there, which I'm not an ice fisherman. I'd never been ice fishing before. And he said he wanted to just go talk about how we might be able to cooperate and share the building, and they wound up giving us that building. So one day on my way to church, I'm walking from my house up the alley, and we actually paid off a little debt he had hanging over, but it wasn't much for the cost of the building we got, and they were able to walk away from it. I was walking up the alley. I'd been at my house. It was like 2-3 blocks away, walking up the alley, and I met an elderly man. Not elderly, but he'd had a hard life, and so he looked a lot older than he was, pushing his Target cart full of cans. And he would say he was out canning, which didn't mean the same thing as it meant to my grandmother or my mother when they were canning.
Yeah.
And he's like, so whose church is this now, and what's going on? I was like, well, I explained to him. He's like, well, I used to go to church here sometime. Can I come in and pray? And I was like, sure, and nicely, the church is handicap accessible, so he's able to push his cart right in there so nobody would steal it while he was in the church praying and make off with his earnings for the day of crushed cans that he had in his cart. And he came in, and that became, sometimes it was daily. Definitely it was weekly. And this guy, Les, would come by, and this was in the early, probably about 94, 95. Yeah, feel free to drop that down so it's not written here, right? So he would come by, and we would share coffee together. We would sit and talk sometimes. Sometimes he would just go in the sanctuary and read or pray. Sometimes he would go in the back room and watch movies. One time he was in the back room watching movies, and I forgot he was there, and I left and set the alarm. And when I came back, the police were there questioning him, and I was like, oh, no. Because he got up and went to the bathroom, and he triggered the alarm. And he would tell me the greatest stories. And, I mean, he was a wonderful storyteller. And one of my favorite stories he told me about was one time he'd been riding the train. And he was Omaha Indian. He'd been raised on a reservation in Nebraska there. And then had moved into the city of Omaha for a while. And then he'd spent a lot of time in the Twin Cities. And so he would tell stories about how, like, one time we were riding the rails, and we were out in New Mexico or somewhere in Arizona. And he said we were camping up in the mountains. Me and a bunch of Indian guys were sitting around the fire, and all of a sudden all these Mexican guys, because I had a lot of Latino friends and Mexican immigrant friends at the time, and he was telling me about all these Mexican guys come running through. And we look at him, and they're like, what's going on? They're like, migre, migre. So we're like, we got up and decided to start running too, but since we were fat and old guys, we weren't running as fast as them. So when the immigration caught us and tackled us, they're like, ¿Cómo se llama? And we looked at him and said, I don't speak Spanish. And he said, all the Mexicans got away that day. And the migres were like, why were you guys running? It's like, well, everybody else was running. We thought we should too. And we would just sit and laugh, and he would tell these stories. And he also told really sad stories about living on the reservation and how the missionaries would come. And it didn't matter what church they were from. His mom always felt like she needed to feed them and give them money. And she was hoping that by being nice to the missionaries, God would be nicer to her and good things would come to her. His dad was abusive, alcoholic,
talked about being just in the backseat of the car with his dad, totally drunk and flying over the hills and terrified of him beating her, of dad being so furiously angry if his mom would give food to these missionaries because they didn't have any food, they didn't have any money. He talked about what it was like living in Omaha, where he lived in a predominantly African-American neighborhood and getting beat up because you're a native. And then moving back to the reservation and getting beat up because now they'd call you the N-word, you know, because you'd lived in the city and you'd been around African-Americans and you'd been acculturated in ways of being in the city. He's like, I didn't really fit in anywhere. And talked about broken relationships and family, marriages, a child who had been killed by an angry lover. And... And just shared the burden of his life. He was a chronic alcoholic, but he was a strong believer in God, and he loved Jesus. He loved people. At one time, we were talking to him, and like, Les, you know, if you want, I could help you find, we got a house that we'd had that was opened up, had some place you could come and stay. And he's like, no, I don't need a place to stay, because I got a great campsite. I'm not homeless. I stay under the bridge over by Dunwoody, off 94 there, and got some great guys that I live with, and I don't want to live in a house. I got a good place. Well, during that same time of getting to know him and hearing his story, I was doing research for my dad. His dad was 48 years old when my dad was born, so it was a huge generation. His parents died both when he was about 15. And he's always wanted to know more about his ancestry. So I'd been doing some research for my dad. And this was at the time that the internet had just, you know, you could just start using it, you know, and looking up stuff. So I was looking up some stuff for my dad. I found that in the 1880s, 1870s, the railroads and other companies made these posters. And they would post them, especially like in places like Denmark and other areas, inviting people to come out and live, you know, in Nebraska and Iowa and Colorado. Along the railroads, they wanted to populate this area. Because after, really up until the Treaty of, at St. Peter, and then later treaties all along there in the 1850s, the Mississippi River was supposed to be the border between what was the European America. And west of the Mississippi was at one time declared to be native lands forever. But starting in the 1850s, that started getting eroded little by little. And after the Dakota War in 1860, all of those treaties were being broken, violated, and the whole model of expansion was just, we're going to take all this land however we want it. So the railroads had pushed through, and they were sending these posters to all across the country. In Europe, and so my great-great-grandfather, my dad's grandfather, saw one of these posters in the 1870s. Otto von Bismarck, who's a German, had just conquered that section of Denmark, and my great-grandfather knew if he stayed in Denmark, he'd have to serve in the German army. So he's a draft dodger. He saw a poster for cheap land in Nebraska. He jumped on a ship. He told his fiancée goodbye. 7 years later, or maybe it was only 4 years later, can't remember, I get the stories of Leah and Rachel and Jacob and my grandfather confused. But she came and joined him. The family story was he showed up at the train station and she had her big spinning wheel, which one of my cousins still has. And he said, we don't have room for that in the house. And she's like, if you don't have room for that in the house, you don't have room for me in the house. And so they did the thing you see in the movies. He picked her up at the train station. They went to the church. They got married. I mean, I found these documents from the posters to the coming in to the marriage license, all dated at the same time. They got married, took her to her house. My great-grandfather had lived in Nebraska the same winter as the great snowstorm, the long winter that Laura Ingalls Wilder talked about in her books. And so... So that was that story that he had. Come on in, welcome.
Sorry, man.
No, grab a chair and join the circle back there. Pull in. We want you in the circle, so we'll just make room to slide you all in. Yeah. We got room for everybody. So I was just sharing kind of my own family story and talking about how my great-grandfather came and wound up moving to Nebraska in the 1880s.
Your great-grandfather was fully Danish?
Fully Danish. And his wife was as well. And they came from Denmark. So they moved on that land. So at the same time I'm learning this, I'm hearing these stories from Les. And what begins to really sink into me is that my great-grandfather was given this huge opportunity. Cheap, almost free land. If you weren't on the railroad area, it was free, if you homesteaded. But if it's closer to the railroad, it was real cheap. And he was given that land and that opportunity to move out there while Les's great-grandparents were being denied opportunity. His great-grandparents and family were rounded up, were forced off that same land in those same areas and pushed onto reservation areas and sand hills where not much grows and not much lives. It was hard to hunt and survive so that my great-grandfather could move in there. And as I'm uncovering this and thinking about that, it becomes so powerful to me as thinking about the place we've been given in this land, of the privilege, of the opportunities. And I always explain it to people like, my great-grandfather wasn't given anything free. They struggled to survive. They almost died, like I said, that first winter when it was super cold. He was living alone at that time in a dugout in a hole in the side of the hill. He had to bring his horse in to sleep with him so he didn't freeze to death. He wasn't given a free pass. During the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, they wound up leaving Nebraska. That's when my dad was a kid because the land hadn't produced any corn for like 7 years. My dad had watched them plant corn every year. It would get about this tall and then wither. They would chop it down. They wound up moving back to Iowa, which is why I'm back in Iowa now. But what he was given was probably even more valuable than free land. He was given a ticket. He was given affirmation. He was given, you are valuable. You are important. You are welcome. You are part of this nation, and we believe in you. You work hard. You obey the law. You follow the rules. And you can make it. This country is for you. That message was passed on to his son, was passed on to my dad, was passed on to me. You are important. You are valuable. You are welcome. Work hard, and this land will take care of you. Simultaneously, the message my friend, Les, and his family were given is you are nothing. You are not welcome. You are less than human. Wish you weren't here. You can never achieve. Stay out of sight. Be gone. And that message got handed down. And the lack of a sense of value and worth drove the despair, drove the depression, that historic trauma carried on into his life. And so at that point, it really hit me of what it means to, like the title of this, of to live on stolen land, of having been given privilege that you didn't earn at the cost of other people being deprivileged, dehumanized. And out of that, I mean, I was already working with the church in North Minneapolis. Was already really struggling to come to terms with the history of racism and especially around issues of African Americans and whites and slavery and Jim Crow and segregation and all those kind of issues. And this added to that. At the same time, we were real involved with the church community in northern Mexico. And I was starting to learn Spanish. I was starting to get involved more in the Latino community in Minneapolis. And so gradually, God has been expanding to that view of the and opportunities given me to struggle with what does it mean to live out justice. So fast forward, I just want to share with you, we've been, for several years, starting in the late 90s, I was leading classes and working with Sanctuary around a program called City Matters. And we would teach these classes about justice and injustice. And I was always struggling to try to find out, I wanted to bring into the classroom things that really hit here in Minnesota. You know, and so we would talk about the lynchings in Duluth. How many of you knew there was a lynching in Duluth? I mean, are you from Minnesota? Okay. You're excused then. How many of you from Minnesota didn't know that? Yeah. It's not taught in most Minnesota history classes, you know. And it was in the 1900s, you know, in the, I think, 1912, 15. It was, you know, not ancient history. And bringing it into our state. And so one of the things I started researching and learning more was about the Dakota Uprising and the war and the lynching of the 38 in Mankato in 1862 and the conditions around that war. So through a process of studying and then teaching about that, the execution took place on December 26th, the day after Christmas. All but, I think, two of the 38 that were executed were baptized Christians. They sat in prison waiting their execution on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. And so on the 26th of December every year, there's a memorial service. Well, this was probably about, I think it was like 2010. Didn't really know what happened in Mankato on the 26th of December, except we knew there was some kind of a memorial service. My wife's family is from not far from there in Blue Earth. And she's like, we were down there at Christmas. She's like, let's go to Mankato Day and see what it is. So we drove up there and we went to Mankato. And we found one little, I mean, now you can find out tons of information about Dakota 38 online. The movie hadn't been released. There wasn't much online about it. Found one little thing in a discussion board online where we could call somebody and come and help serve the meal. So we went down and helped serve the meal. We went to by the White Buffalo, by the library. The execution actually took place right by where the library is. And there's a White Buffalo, stone, limestone buffalo that's there kind of as a memorial. So we went down there and saw the riders come into town. And one of the riders was the staff carrier that year was Peter Lankeek. And he's from Crow Creek. And he shared at the monument site. And as he talked about the purpose of the ride, as he talked about reconciliation, as he talked about remembering yet moving forward, I was like, I want to get to know this guy. But honestly, like, I'd had like two Native friends in my whole life to that point. And so we went back to the church where the meal was. We helped serve the meal. And I was like, I'm going to go up and talk to him. And I was like almost nervous or scared. I don't know what I was going to say. I didn't know, like, you know. And so I go up and I talk to this guy. And he's like, man, it was great to talk to you. And we get done talking. I think he's going to, like, maybe shake my hand or I don't know, you know, what he wants to do. He's going to pat me on the head. He's tall. He's a big guy. And he just reaches out and he just gives me this huge embrace. And I went back home and that was in December. And just continued thinking about it. He was telling me, the movie's coming out, and you're in Minneapolis. Help us get the word out. Help us share about what's happening. Because I was like, is there any way I can, you know, support or encourage what you're doing? And I went back home. So, right now I'm conversating with myself on how much of the story to tell you and how much not to. And I want to share with you the whole story, but I don't want you to think at all that I'm trying to manufacture anything to try to make myself appear to be something more than I am. Does that make sense? But I want you to understand the way I've been, the way I think if we trust God and step into relationships, that God can use us and the Creator uses us and opens doors. And so I went home and just like, I don't really know what that means, and you know, but I'm here. What can I do? And one of the things I had heard and seen is that the ride began out of a dream. Jim Miller, who is predominantly Lakota, but has some Dakota blood on his mother's side as well, had had a dream about the 38 being hung. And that was before he even knew, mentally knew about that experience. But he had had a dream about that. And then some people explained to him about the dream, and out of that arose the vision to carry out the ride year after year. And so I'd gotten up early one morning, was going to drive my daughter to school. I laid back down on the couch just to sleep a couple minutes because she wasn't ready yet. Mm-hmm. I fall asleep. I never have dreams that make any kind of sense. I mean, my dreams, you're like, you're walking and then you're on a rope and then you're, you know, and you see somebody and it's not who it is, but you think it's somebody else. I mean, my dreams make no sense. You can't draw a storyline out of them. They're just random impressions. And I had a dream that was hauntingly, like, real. And it involved going from Mankato to Crow Creek, which I've never been to Crow Creek, with people that I didn't know. And it involved sacrifice and different things. And I woke up and I was just like, that was just weird. It involved the remains of the 38 and bringing things back to Crow Creek. And I remember just thinking, I don't know where that came from or where I thought it, but and my first thought was like to put it out of my mind, and then I'm like, but the ride started out of a dream. Maybe there's a reason I need to hold on to this. And so later that day I called Peter and I said, I've had this dream and I don't really know what to think. And he's like, it's really interesting. He said, I'll share it with the elders and see what people think. And out of that dream, I was invited to Pine Ridge to go and meet with Jim Miller and to participate in a Wasipia sweat lodge to seek the meaning of the dream. And I remember at the time, just like one of my friends I brought with me was, I brought him just because he's like super good at spiritual discernment, like stuff like, I don't know what's going to happen if I go to a sweat lodge. Is there going to be demons flying out of the fire? Is there going to be, you know, I don't know what to expect. But I also want to like be open to what God might be doing. I brought my one friend that I'd known from Northwestern College, and I just knew he was a Native American guy from Minneapolis. I actually thought he was Ojibwe. On the way out there, he discloses to us like, oh, I was born on Pine Ridge. I haven't been back since I was three. Wow. You know, we're on our way out to Pine Ridge, have no intention of stopping in Crow Creek, but my business partner, my friend who's from Mexico, and the other guy, they're like, oh, look, there's a casino. Let's stop there for the night, and we can get a hotel. So we pull off, and then all of a sudden, we find out we're at Crow Creek. And we meet people at Crow Creek that are being part of the ride, and the whole trip just fell together to be more than we ever could have imagined it to be. We went out and met with Jim, and then came back. Had a very powerful experience, all of us. My Mexican friend was like, I've never felt more welcome anywhere than on the reservation where we were at. And then that next year, I helped Jim several different times when the movie would come to Minneapolis, setting some stuff up in different places and connecting some things. I mean, just small things. And then in 2012, I actually went on the ride. Last year, I wasn't able to go on all the ride, but went one day to the powwow. And the most... I just want to share one thing with you here, and then we'll share some questions. Is when we went on the ride, I'm a pretty outgoing kind of person, and I sought advice from several different people that I really trust, including Jim Bear, including Pastor Jin and Curtis DeYoung and other people, and just really being present and being quiet. And I remember when we went out there the first day, and the ride starts at the there's a dam now on the Missouri River there that has flooded much of the land. But where the dam is where the barges pulled up. Because after the Dakota War, exiled Natives, mainly the women and children, but a lot of men as well, were forced to encamp that winter below Fort Snelling. And if you went on the Sacred Sites tour, you went there. In the spring, most of the people were loaded up on barges, shipped down the Mississippi. Most of them in, where's the town that Mark Twain's from in Missouri? Hannibal, Missouri, were taken off the barges, put in cattle cars, shipped across Missouri in cattle cars, put on barges. I'm not even going to comment on just the inhumanity of the journey. Shipped up again to Crow Creek, where they were dropped off at an abandoned military post, and they were kept as prisoners. So that's where the ride began at. And most people, when I got there, thought I was like a really quiet guy. And I spent honestly like the first 5 days hardly speaking to anyone and trying to figure out what my role was, why I was there, how to even talk or behave. Peter had said, oh, we got plenty of horses. Come along. You'll get on a horse. And the first day I was like, I'm just going to walk. And I had no, you know, Peter didn't offer me a horse. Nobody offered me a horse. I didn't know what I was doing. But I just walked along and feeling the land and walking off the reservation and following along beside the horses and the power and the sacredness of that. The second day, this guy offered me to help share his horse, and the rest of the time we would trade off driving and riding, and I was so honored of that opportunity. But I want to just share with you into the second day a couple things that I wrote at this time. This is an email I sent to some people that had helped me be able to come on the trip. Sunday night, sitting in my room, wondering what is happening and how to put it into words. First, just some thank yous, I say, and then I say, first, this has been an exercise in cross-cultural communication like nothing I've done before. I don't know if you were like me in junior high, I hope not, but I was a hot mess, trying to find my way socially, wanting to make friends, not quite knowing the rules I was supposed to follow. There was this feeling that you're awkward and inappropriate. While the motivation and ability to process this has changed in the last 35 plus years, the same feelings I've experienced in this past week. Was I just slighted because I did something really stupid, or was I not slighted at all? Is that a joke I should laugh at, or was that a serious statement? I know that was a joke and everybody's laughing, but I have no idea what the punchline was. This is a very new culture, even language, hand signals that I don't understand. And people have been very patient and welcoming on every turn. I'm in awe that this beautiful culture is so unknown to most Americans, yet is one of the original cultures of this land. An example of cultural norms and expectations. The people I did know coming in never gave me a pass or an introduction to the group. I guess I expected a little of that connection power that is common with white Americans. For example, Peter could have said, hey, this is Mark, he's my friend, and in essence said that I'm safe. Instead, he let me go, and it forced me and other non-natives to stand on our own 2 feet. We had to earn respect naturally, work through our struggle to understand and connect. I've tried to live by a line I've often said, listen, learn. It's been quite tough. But as a result, some people here really think I'm a quiet person. LOL. In retrospect, I am so thankful I didn't get an introduction or pass. First of all, it would not have been culturally appropriate. And secondly, I'm a better man because of the struggle I had to make to meet people and be myself. Second thing I learned, you don't know a fucking thing, Whitey. That was said to me in love by the guy who let me ride his horses, let me drive his truck, and who has been painfully honest with me at every turn. He was explaining to me how broken and twisted the reservation system is. At one time, he was breaking it down to me how sovereign nations are the most federally controlled places in the USA. Not knowing how to respond, I let a casual, I know, slip out of my mouth. Just like white folks, we think we have to add to the silence to punctuation of our awareness. That's when he cut me off with his blunt yet true statement. I was reminded of how stupid and privileged I am, and all I could say is, you're right. I'm writing with men and women who are the descendants of those who were executed in Mankato, who were pardoned by Lincoln and then imprisoned in Davenport, Iowa for years. A young man who rides with me often on horse and in the truck is teaching me a ton. He's a direct descendant of Chief Bigfoot, who fought with Sitting Bull at Little Bighorn in the defeat of General Custer and was later massacred at Wounded Knee. And if you've ever seen those pictures of the Wounded Knee Massacre, there's a picture of a frozen person kind of leaning forward. That is Guy Looking Horse's great something grand. That's his grandfather.
Wow.
And so all of a sudden these images of some disconnected history became the stories of friends that I had been getting to know. My friend who reminded me of our little I know shared how his dad hated all white men, had been beaten up and fought them at every chance he could. I can't understand this legacy, but I can listen and learn to those who have such a legacy, and I am beginning to learn so much. I realize how my sense of geography is tied to my identity. I know places in the USA by what state they're in. However, the people I'm writing with again and again speak of the reservations they're from and visit and lived on, and it seems to have little to do with the state, has little or no significance. I never realized how many reservations there are. It often seems as if we view the U.S. map as almost in an opposite way. After asking a few times, what state is that in? Or where is that at? I realized I need to shut up, go look at a map, and learn something and stop asking stupid questions. My blunt, honest friend is also interested in talking about the Jesus I know, who is much unlike the Christ that was forced on him and his parents. I'll be riding in his truck again, riding his prized horses, as we joke and talk, and maybe even bump into that strange beast of community. Third, I have a lot to learn about love, prayer, and forgiveness. Every morning we begin the day with a circle for prayers to the Creator. We share in the chanupa, the pipe. We pray for strength and for families back home. And Peter always reminds us to pray for the people that pass us on the road, especially those who give us evil looks. Pray for the towns we ride through and the homes we pass through. He reminds us of the power of praying for people who might even hate us in what we are doing. Yet he sees the changing of attitudes and the new welcomes for the riders as proof that the Creator is using this ride as a way to heal and bring reconciliation. And so a couple days after that, I'll just tell you one more story and then we can move into some conversation. We were riding and now we're into Minnesota and we've moved past Pipestone. So now we're riding in the area actually where the war took place. Where the Dakota were eventually rounded up. We weren't far from where Camp Release was. It was a ways north of us, but it was in that area where homes of settlers were burned. And settlers were killed. And we went to one little town in that area, and Peter shared, some of the young people shared at the school we went to. The guy I'd been riding with, the guy that told me you don't know a fucking thing, Whitey, invited me to share part of my story at that. And as I stood there, the town we were in was Tyler. And it's a Danish community, strongly Danish. And I shared that piece about my own story. And Peter, when he got up and spoke, he said, we want to be the first to say we're sorry. Horrible, horrible things happened. On both sides. So we're riding that day, and I'm riding with a bunch of these young men, and it's snowy, and it's cold. And it's not hard to imagine what it would have looked like 150 years ago. Just take out a few of the tree lines and the houses and a couple of the roads and the pavement. And I was riding across there, and the staff that the staff carrier carries has 38 eagle feathers for the 38 that were executed. And the Dakota speak is, as we ride, the 38 are riding with us. Their ancestors are with us. And as we were riding that day, and I see in the, you know, smoke whiffing up from a little farmhouse over here, I was thinking about what it would have looked like with Little Crow or the other bands that were writing, and I'm riding with their descendants over those hills on these horses, and thinking of farmhouses that were being burned and settlers that were massacred in their homes. I mean, on the flip side of the story, there were people that had welcomed Dakota people that would come into their homes and share meals. They saw them right up to them. They didn't know the war had started. They opened their homes to them, and they were killed. Horrific things happened. And as I'm riding with these men, I'm thinking, while my family did not live in southern Minnesota, they just as much, they were the same people. They were the same stories who crowded in. And on my mom's side of the family, her family moved into northeast Iowa in the 1860s, as soon as the land was opened up, and they were from Germanic backgrounds. And so the people that were executed, were killed, the settlers that were killed, were my family. Not directly, but the same story, the same people. And that night, as we were sitting around talking about the ride and sharing, I shared that idea with the guys we were riding with. I said, you know, as you share that the 38 and the ancestors are riding with us, what does it mean if my ancestors are riding with us too? And there was kind of a silence, and then one of the guys said, that's, I think, what this ride's about. And so, as we go into the question time, I don't know what it means. I don't know how to do this. But what I do know is that if we don't step into the conversation, into the experience, we won't be part of the healing. We won't be healed. We, white people, need to be healed. And I found so much openness and love. And I know the guys that go on the ride, the guys and women that are part of the ride, represent one slice. I mean, I know there's a lot of different opinions about how to move forward and what reconciliation and healing mean. And I'm not naive to that. But I know that by opening ourselves up to relationships and people and stories, it then motivates me, at least, to look at the bigger systemic issues. And by having interpersonal relationships where I see the impact of the injustices around us, that then fuels me to care about the systemic issues that need to be changed. And I think there are some people that can deal with just the systemic without the interpersonal, but I can't. And I know it's not enough just to deal with having friends and enjoying that. We have to struggle with those both levels that are there. One of the young men I've stayed in close contact with since the ride is from Sisseton. And during the ride, he was always one of the guys that would lead in the songs, in the chanupa, and the prayers. It's interesting, too, because a lot of the guys knew, because I'd be on the phone with my business partner, Jose, back home, and I spoke Spanish, and a lot of these young men would come and share with me their stories about if they'd been incarcerated, how they connected and they learned Spanish with the Latino guys. And that connection of indigenous people across the Americas. And my friend Seth from Sisseton that I was mentioning, he even shared with me a song that was a song to sing in the sweat lodge that when he was in a prison, he translated into Spanish. So he'd say, so the paisas could come and participate in the sweat lodges and sing these songs to the Creator in Spanish. And a couple years ago, I had helped him out with one little thing he needed help with. And he said, you know what, for that, would you mind if I made something for you? And I was like, if you want. And so he called and he had told me to come down to Coldwater Springs because he was coming to town and he wanted to get some water. And Coldwater Springs is at the heart of the creation story for the Dakota, and we met there, and he makes drums, and he had given me this drum. And at that time, too, he said, man, it's been really good to get to know you. He said, when you first showed up at the ride, man, everybody was talking about, like, who is this white guy? And what's he doing here? And we thought maybe you were a reporter, or we thought maybe you were this or that. And he called me last night. His family story is, his name is Seth Eastman. Does that name ring a bell to anyone?
Yeah.
Eastman.
Who's the historic Seth Eastman?
Photographer. Or a painter.
Painter.
Painter and military guy, I believe, too.
He was a painter and military guy that came to the to Minnesota in the 1850s, 1860s. And he was stationed at Fort Snelling. And he did a lot of the paintings that are at the Capitol. Yep. And a lot of them depict the Dakota. Well, he went over by Lake Calhoun where Cloudman, and Seth told me last night how to say Cloudman's name in Dakota, and I won't even try. But he was the leader of the clan that camped on the banks of Lake Calhoun. And Cloudman gave him, he took part of a treaty, one of his daughters, and Seth Eastman had a Dakota wife. They had a daughter, and she had several sons. One of her sons was Charles Eastman, who was the first Native American physician. And he was the attending physician at
Wounded Knee.
Seth, my friend from Sisseton, is a descendant of that family. And he's like, I don't know why my mom gave me that goddamn name, Seth. But he said, probably there's some reason to it. And he also goes by his Dakota name, Iokpia. And so he made this for me. And what I want to do is, I have no idea. He said, just use it. And last night I talked to him. He said, would it be appropriate to bring it here? He's like, that's what it's for. Because he also told me, I don't want you to just show it off to people, like a show and tell item. But you'll know how to use it. And one of the greatest lessons I've learned from Jim Miller and Seth and others is consistently when I'm with Jim or Peter and people come to them and say, what should I do? They say, learn the truth and the Creator will show you. Seth gave me this drum. I said, how should I use it? He's like, look, Creator will show you. Sometime maybe if you're just feeling down, just go and play it a little. So I want us to just sit here for a few minutes. And I'm just going to lightly drum, and then I want us to have some conversation, and let the drum, let the spirit speak to you. Got about 15 minutes. I think what I would like to do is just to give each person a chance if you want to say anything in the room to, we'll just pass the drum and to just share any words or thoughts you have of what you feel called to.
Yeah. I think I can relate a lot to your story of I'm white. That's not a secret. but I work on several different reservations. And how do you walk alongside someone who shares a very different history than you do? But at the same time, Jane Barry's words from last night kind of echoed with me of letting kind of the Native voice speak up into the church instead of the church speaking down on to the Native voice. And how do you be that vessel when you are of a different background? And
that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Sarah, I think, thinking back to what Seth said, we'll use this to pass it.
Yeah. I probably had, like, fairy tale notions of Native Americans growing up, and always had a heart for them, and probably was rooting for them. And so heard about this conference, was like, yeah, you know, and if anything, not like I had, like, a conscious awareness or anything, but I'd be rooting and like, yeah, we done very much wrong and stuff and whatever, and but it was kind of funny because not fun, there's no funny, but like it wasn't until I would side with them. And but it wasn't until the other day, my cousin, long-lost cousin, she's, like, doing ancestry stuff in here. She's telling me, she, like, showed me an article and, you know, like, it's kind of funny. I want to look into it because we have a family member with the last name Eastman and stuff. And back and forth. Both sides didn't be good to each other, you know, and the whites and the natives and killing each other and whatever, and how violent it got, and like both sides killed each other's babies and did it in very bad ways, you know, and it was the first time I was like thinking, oh wow, I know this is like not for right now, but like, oh wow, our babies were hurt too, you know? And it's like the first time I took any, like, oh, huh, you know? I don't know if I'm explaining myself. Like, I was always like, yay, 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 rooting for Native Americans and stuff. And I'm like, oh, our babies too, you know? Because, like, I didn't live then, you know? But then, like, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but when I heard you say about, in the ride, and like I'm like, why is he sharing this? You know, like it's kind of getting uncomfortable. Like the ride's supposed to be about them, you know. But then you were imagining, you know, your ancestors too, our ancestors, and then you were brave enough to share that with the rest of the people, and then they wonderfully said, yeah, that this is what this is about. This ride is about both of our ancestors riding with us, you know? And so that was pretty cool.
My first name is Paul, and I'm 61 years old, and it amazes me how little history I know. A little true history I know. And it feels like it's very important each day for us to learn how to hold hands with each other. How important that is. Each and every day.
I think what I was just reminded of and just deeply touched by again of just even your piece of saying sometimes we try to add to the silence and studying reconciliation and trying to find my place, you know, where to stand in solidarity, just that idea of listen, listen, learn, just continues to be brought up, and just the beauty in listening and how important that is to just truly kind of find our shalom. So. Mm.
I'm always looking for ways to help and to reach out, and then also at the same time to be healed from the past, the intergenerational trauma that both sides have gone through and then the side that I've gone through. So I think that the biggest thing, since I'm always looking for answers, I'm always looking for ways to do things, is to have the silence and have the quiet. And then there was that quote that I wrote down that you said, and what should I do? Learn the truth and the Creator will show you. It's really, really pertinent for me.
That really spoke to me too, was when you said the Creator will show you. There's Like Paul said, I mean, I'm only 30, but there's a lot of history I don't know. I have a lot to learn. And I spent a large portion of my life trying to figure out where I stand and do my best to empathize with everyone, whatever their situation may be. Being here, I feel like that helps me out just a little bit more. Thank you for sharing, Mark.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I really appreciated the honesty and also the risk-taking that is involved. Not more so one side than the other, but just to be open and vulnerable with your history. I think that's something that we aren't anymore, and we've managed to detach ourselves from. And I think that learning from, like, our Native brothers and sisters, that it's something that we should be yearning to be connected with our history and not just to let it live in one space, is something that I've really been reflecting on. So I think that it was really interesting to hear how that developed for you. And again, just how much there really is to learn past the history that we were taught in, like, books, and how it's not just for other people. It's very important and just humane to approach it from the standpoint of other people, but we do gain true healing out of it. So I appreciate hearing how you did.
I think this weekend, and how it kind of fits into my story and journey, I'm a second grade teacher, and it's only my second year, but I think working in a really diverse setting with students and families and in a community that have hundreds of different backgrounds and stories, I think I've recently felt the weight of the privilege of being that voice of an educator to those students and making sure the things that I'm sharing are of truth and are not solely through the lens of, like, a Western context and a Western voice, A, because that's mine, and B, a lot of our curriculum is written only from that side of the story. And so how do I, as someone who has the privilege of educating and sharing things, share the whole story, share their story, and not just mine. And so I've just appreciated the open conversations and the truth that's been spoken to help widen and prepare me to be truthful in what I teach and share.
Amen. Thank you. And thank you also for sharing the drum with us. I just think that has a really strangely powerful voice and spirit drum, and if I could break the rules a little bit and ask you a question, what ways did you personally like heal or even through healing find that like discover wounds that you didn't that like I think are sometimes inherent or a part of whiteness that we maybe don't realize that we have or we carry. So yeah, just personal wounds or as a white person wounds that you found were healed through your process.
What's your name again?
Josh.
So the first thing I thought of, Josh, is when I went on the ride, I was in a very low place, empty place spiritually. And a lot of that came out of experiences of working with evangelical Christians in areas of reconciliation, diversity, multicultural awareness, support. And I was very bitter and questioning God, even his very existence, questioning what I've been taught about spirituality. And when I went on the ride, I prayed more than I had for probably the whole year combined. And I saw the love of God displayed in ways that, you know, and I saw the power of God at work in healing and forgiveness. And so, in a very personal way, that way, the ride reawakened my faith in God. And it was okay for me to have faith in God through Jesus and to walk and share the Chinupa with people that may not share that faith in Jesus, but share that same deep love for the Creator. And, immediately that was one of the very powerful ways in that, so.
Couple things for me. Thank you for sharing, Mark, of course. But I struggle for me is that I'm not in places where I'm able to listen, learn enough. I'm not circles, so that's like something that I'm seeking, and it's for me it's hard to put myself into situations because of, you know, my own perceived social awkwardness and different. It's harder for me to jump out into those avenues. So, I mean, that's an excuse I make for myself so that when I don't do it, then, you know, it's just because of who you are, so even it's harder for you, whatever. So it's just stuff like lies I tell myself. But needing to still get into those situations where I can listen, learn, and then also realizing I still have a very large circle of white friends from various other areas, and like struggling with how do I share a very different mindset, a very different thing with those people, and like without them just throwing up massive walls and whatever, because it never goes well. You know, speaking the truth in love is something that Pastor Jin says a lot, but it's very hard for me to find the right ways to do that. So it's don't want to like, and then I guess being okay with like letting friendships like fall away that maybe aren't. It's just the time to move on in some different areas. So that's just a couple things on my mind a lot.
Thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for sharing. I appreciate learning more about this history in a church context. I find it very hard to look at history and see hope for the church. And so knowing people who have hope for reconciliation on any level is always a really helpful reminder for me.
Thank you. Not my thinking that there's any healing that has to be done with white folks. White folks, most white folks I know need to repent. And repenting is turning around, turning our views around, and transforming our values. And I guess we can't do that without learning first about the things that the lies we've been told and the truths that have been withheld. I guess this weekends like this and things like this and the whole spin series that's coming out, are you aware that there's three other churches that are doing things this month around this doctrine of discovery? I've got some flyers in my car. I'll bring if you want some. Anyway, it's good that we're doing things like this. It's needed. The more, the better. Thank you for the drumming.
Thank you, Mark. My grandmother was a Cherokee princess. Okay. From Korea. No, it's kind of funny.
Insider.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had to be fooled for
it. Oh, really? I just hear that from so many people. It's pretty cool. But I really appreciate what you're saying about how there's kind of a white privilege is so insidious that even the work of speaking the truth and repenting can be another form of white privilege. Like now, for those white people who are in the process of repenting, how do Native people and African Americans and others minister to white people while they're grieving, learning the truth? So it's we're all treading dangerous water here. But I'm a pastor to many white members in our church, and there is, I think, real healing that is required, because when a group of people are raised on the formula, I think white people at a very early age, I'm speaking metaphorically here, don't get regular breast milk from their mom and are handed over directly to being nursed by American Empire. Mm-hmm. So white children are fed patriotism from day one. Even if you hate your own mom and dad and hate your siblings and hate your family, you must love America. So this is very much like Plato's Republic. Extracting children from natural relating to becoming a ward of the state, mm-hmm. and having loyalty to the nation state of America is a primary mission of America. And no children are indoctrinated and brainwashed to fealty to the state more than white people. And then what they get for that kind of loyalty to the state is a sense of supremacy, that white Americans are inherently superior to all other kinds of people. And then when we hear the truth, the real truth, as you've shared about your own family background, and that we're not the most civilized people, we're the most uncivilized people if we actually look at history, then the supremacist assumptions dissolve, and then who are we? And when white people are led into this journey of speaking the truth, and all those assumptions crumble, then there's just a nothingness, a void. And then we lose our humanity. And if we go from supremacy to void, then I think we become useless, including useless for the work of reconciliation and healing and building something better. So we do need the church, or we need something to hold our people in community while they journey from supremacist nonsense and inhumanity into a kind of broken but on the journey of healing humanity. And it cannot be done alone. It has to be done in some kind of constructive community. So I think that's why, as crazy as the church is, you're still in the church, I'm still in the church, because I'm not sure how we're going to have people go from inhumanity to humanity without some community holding us together.
That's good.
First off, thanks a lot for sharing. It helped me to understand a lot of what I was going through and create some healing within me. What I liked about it is you're not into this straight line direction of travel. You're on this spiritual river with all the twists and bends and other rivers joining in, few rapids, few waterfalls, but keep on journeying, and I'm sure you will get to the great ocean where all the waters meet as one.
Amen.
And notice you shedding a few tears there, and I think it takes a lot more bravery and courage for men to shed a few tears than it does for them to mindlessly fight.
Amen.
Thank you.
Amen.
Yate. Mark Charles Yenishia. Sin Bukajina Nishlin. Do Tohiklini Bashachin. Sin Bukajina Bashache. Do Tohiklini Bashanoa. When God called me into a new wave of this journey about almost 12, 13 years ago, I was called to pastor a church in Denver called the Christian Indian Center. And I had 6 months after I was called before I got there, and God, in the 6 months, gave me this huge desire to understand biblically what it meant to be racially reconciled. So we did a survey of the Bible, and I just want to share with you briefly the definition that we came up with, because I think it points very much to what God's doing in your life, Mark, and the story he's giving you. But in obedience to God, racial reconciliation is a commitment to building cross-cultural relationships of forgiveness, repentance, love, and hope that result in walking in beauty with our fellow man and God. And your story reminds me of that definition. And for sharing with us.
Thank you. Before we wrap up, I just want to say one final thing. In Beverly Tatum, who wrote Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria, talks about privilege. And in the video series Race the Power of Illusion, she shares, like, none of us ask to be born into the place we were at. But we are where we are. And so she says, always be asking the question, who's not included at the tables I'm at? And what can I do with the people and the resources I have? What can I do right here, today? And this summer, I was thinking about, I knew, you know, Seth was going on the ride again. He doesn't have horses. And I was down at my parents' farm. My dad has 6 horses, 4 young ones that never get ridden much. And so Seth goes on the ride, but he doesn't have his own horses, so he rides when somebody else lets him take his horses and stuff. And so I don't remember who I asked first, because I was trying to just feel out if this was something. And I think I talked to Seth. And again, and white power and privilege is so insidious that
I really have to watch how I ask questions, because if you ask questions wrong, it feels like you're making a recommendation to people. Because of just how people are used to interacting with white folks. So even as I called Seth and talked to him and feeling out, does he have horses this year? Was he looking? And he's like, I've been praying that we could get some horses. I don't have any. And I got a place to keep some, but I don't have any. And then I put the shot over the bow of my dad to see, would he be interested to give up his horses for a while? I don't know what it would look like. And so now we're in the process of taking the four younger horses to Sisseton, and Seth is coming to get them. My dad's getting them their shots. And it's just been exciting. I mean, watching my dad get excited about having his horses be part of this ride, watching Seth deal with that. And I think I wanted to share that because it's not a big deal. It's nothing great or newsworthy in the area of reconciliation. But it is about using the resources and the connections you have. And Stephen, as you talk, like, the process I started on with the whole Dakota 38 thing started just by reading books and learning. And so put yourself into a place of learning, so when the relationships open up, you're able to step into them.
Amen.
So let me just pray, and then we're going to go listen to Mark Charles here with this.
All right.
Creator, Yahweh, Tekashila, we thank you for the sunrise, for this day, for the people in this room. And just speak to us as to how we should follow you, how we should seek you, to bring peace and justice that reflects your love to the world around us. In Christ Jesus, we pray these things.